It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin actor and director who travels to classrooms introducing kids to Shakespeare.
First, three reports just out show that even though Wisconsin utility companies are meeting the state's goals for renewable energy, we're still lagging behind lots of other states. The reports are out from the consulting firm Clean Edge, the State Public Service Commission, and the Wisconsin Sustainable Business Council.
Thomas Content wrote about these three reports. He's with us now to talk about how Wisconsin's sustainability efforts measure up. He's the reporter on energy and clean technology for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with this report from consulting firm Clean Edge. It says our sustainability ranking dropped to 30th from 19th a year ago. Substantial drop. Why did that happen?
Yeah, it was one of the biggest drops in the country, and they're seeing a couple of factors here. Mainly it's because so many states are moving so rapidly to develop solar and wind technologies, and also because Wisconsin isn't seeing as much venture capital in that space either. One of the things that they noted is just kind of a decline in interest in kind of opening the doors to clean tech companies.
And we saw in your piece, you quoted a renewable energy advocate saying that that particular report should be a wake-up call for Wisconsin. What's the case they're making for the state to do more to boost things like solar and wind power?
Well, the case they make is that it's homegrown. It's homegrown, and once you put these installations in, the fuel cost is free. Obviously, they're intermittent, so there's challenges with that. But they're job creators as far as local jobs, and the concern that a lot of folks have raised is how much we rely on kind of energy that's produced outside Wisconsin to power Wisconsin.
Now, from the perspective of people who are supporting that move to renewable energy, that report of the three that came out is kind of the bad news one. One that they might see as better news, the state's renewable energy standard mandates that the state produces 10% of its power from renewable sources by the end of the year. The State Public Service Commission tried to measure that. How are we doing there?
Well, we're doing better than we beat the target in essence. We beat it 1 year early in 2013. The utilities had gotten to that 10%, so growing from about 4% in 2006 to 10%. And this new report, which just came out, shows that we moved up to 11% as of the end of 2014. And there's some utilities leading the way. Xcel Energy out of Eau Claire is generating nearly 20% of its power from renewables as of the end of last year.
Now, so far we've said the words solar and wind, Tom. This also includes biomass in this report.
That's true, and that biomass is a whole range of things. So sometimes some utilities generate electricity from the methane on landfills, so it takes a greenhouse gas that's coming out of landfills and converts that into power. And then, of course, you've got anaerobic digesters, which is taking one of Wisconsin's plentiful resources, which is, thanks to our great dairy industry, we're taking cow manure and making that into electricity. And then the third kind is there's actually We Energy's built a biomass power plant that burns wood waste up in north central Wisconsin. So there's several varieties there.
Now, that's a 10% mandate. 10% of our energy portfolio in the state is supposed to come from these renewables. How does that 10% stack up to what other states are doing?
Well, that's the thing. There are other states such as Minnesota and Iowa that have moved to a 25% standard and even higher. And California actually just adopted a 50% standard. In part because they're moving more aggressively on greenhouse gases, having their own, if you will, cap and trade greenhouse gas regulation. Ours standard is 10%, and it remains 10% of whatever the utility's energy sales are. And so the thinking was when it was passed that electricity sales were going to grow over time, and so would this mandate. But electricity sales have flattened out after the Great Recession. So right now, the concern that the advocates have is that we are we're kind of in need of a next generation standard, if you will, is the way one of the folks in the article described it.
Talking to Tom Content with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about sustainable energy production in Wisconsin. We got a trifecta, three different reports trying to measure how we're doing in the state. One we talked about, consulting firm Clean Edge, found we dropped in when it comes to states and renewable energy. One from the Public Service Commission. And then the third, Tom, Wisconsin Sustainable Business Council put out a report. Where did renewable energy fit into that?
Well, that was just one of the things. They take a pretty holistic and broader look at sustainability. Some people call sustainability the triple bottom line because it encompasses both economic, environment, and social. But on the energy side, they certainly noted that we've surpassed that 10% goal. But then on the other side, they're saying, you know, we're still a fossil fuel dependent state, 10th most dependent on coal in the nation. So that's a concern that they raised.
And why are we dependent on coal, particularly here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's just that's been our history. That's been kind of our manufacturing heritage to power our economy. And then in the last 10 years or so, we've seen new coal plants built in right near Wausau, and then down in Oak Creek. That's the power plant that We Energy's built and is co-owned by Madison Gas and Electric, as well as WPPI. And obviously, one of the big things going forward is that is being watched by everybody on my beat is the EPA greenhouse gas rules for power plants. And so some of the renewable advocates are saying that could be the state's best hope for adding more renewables. But there are concerns about the cost of the plan, and the utilities and the Walker administration have raised concerns about how some of the timelines for compliance in that proposal.
And as I understand it, the Public Service Commission for comments to the EPA on these greenhouse gas rules said Wisconsin isn't as suited to expanding renewable energy as a lot of other states. Why would that be?
Well, we don't have the winds of the Great Plains that, say, Iowa does. And so even though the wind technology is getting stronger every year as the turbines get taller and the blades get longer, southern Minnesota and Iowa certainly have much better wind resources. So if you look at that 11% that we were able to get for our renewables last year, a lot of that was wind farms that Wisconsin utilities built in other states, including both Minnesota and Iowa. And the PSC's point there is that Wisconsin, because Wisconsin utilities built those wind farms, they want Wisconsin to get credit for those emissions reductions, the carbon credits, if you will, that are associated with those projects.
And one of the things evaluated, I think, in that consulting firm, Clean Edge's report, it looked at research and development and production of alternative energy sources, and Wisconsin lagging there. I understand that there is a new kind of incubator coming in Milwaukee.
That's right. It's a kind of a partnership between kind of the state's large energy companies, including We Energies and Johnson Controls and Rockwell Automation, as well as the engineering schools at Madison, Milwaukee, MSOE, and others. It's called the Midwest Energy Research Consortium, which is a multi-state group, but they're launching an incubator and energy for energy that actually could help Wisconsin's rankings in this report. When I talked to the author, he said the fact that we didn't have a clean energy incubator was kind of a strike against us, and so we can mark that off our checklist.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
Opening. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Thomas Content, reporter on energy and clean technology for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about three new reports on sustainable energy efforts here in Wisconsin. You can see his piece on these reports at the Central Time Facebook page. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Milwaukee-based actor Ron Scott Fry has been traveling around the world introducing kids to Shakespeare for years. He tells us how he fell in love with the Bard and why he thinks Shakespeare is particularly relevant for kids.
The first time I encountered Shakespeare that I can remember was when I was a sophomore in high school, and it was an absolutely terrible experience. And so I went through a rough patch in high school in terms of my relationship with Shakespeare. And the next time I experienced it was in college, and I had a fantastic teacher up at St. Norbert College, and I fell in love with it. Thank God. In 1992, I was working with a company called Midwest Children's Theater, and someone called and asked if we had anyone who played William Shakespeare, and the person who answered the phone said yes, because when you're a struggling theater company, the answer is always yes. And we got together, and she asked, "Who here has an outfit that looks like Shakespeare's?" And since I had the suit, I got the gig. I got this job playing Shakespeare because I happened to have the costume. And that's how it started. And since then, I've done it for more than 80,000 people everywhere from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. to Florence, Italy. My goals are specifically to go in to help reduce any fear or intimidation that people feel and to get them excited about the work. Well met, my good and gentle cousins. My name is William Shakespeare, and I have murdered the king. I will frequently do Hamlet's soliloquy that begins, "To be or not to be, that is the question," a speech in which Hamlet is contemplating suicide. And I like that speech for several reasons. First of all, it's some of the most brilliant writing in the history of the English language. And I like it because in a lot of my audiences, I will find out afterwards, either from their friends or from them, that there are people in the audience who have thought about suicide. And that's very, very difficult, but it's a very, very real moment. And I think it's important for some of those people who have thought about suicide or considered suicide to understand that that's kind of a universal feeling, that Shakespeare wrote about that, and that this isn't unique to their situation. People talk about Shakespeare's universality, how Shakespeare is universal, and it's universal in a lot of ways, but one of the ways that I think is most important is that the emotions, the situations, the decisions involved for characters in Shakespeare's plays are all very, very contemporary to things that we see happening in our world or that we experience ourselves.
Ron Scott Fry is the Artistic Director of Optimist Theater in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Ron Scott Fry is with us now for more about kids and Shakespeare. Ron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, I wonder, bringing Shakespeare to kids, I mean, it's a different language, or, you know, it's English, but a very different English. It can be hard to follow, even for a grown-up American. How much warm-up do you give kids? How much do you talk them through what's going on before introducing them to a bit of Shakespeare?
Very early in the program, I'll usually do one of two speeches. I'll either do the prologue from Romeo and Juliet, or I'll do Puck's first speech from A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I tell them what I'm going to do, and then I go into it. And for instance, if I was going to do the prologue from Midsummer Night's Dream, I'll set it up, find out who knows anything about Midsummer Night's Dream, get everyone's attention, and then begin. Like, dude, there's these two families, right? And they're like totally fat with it. It's like they're the richest families in all Verona. But, and then I'll go on and I'll do the soliloquy in a kind of a ridiculous pseudo contemporary slang. And then I'll do it using Shakespeare's language right after. So that's one way of introducing people, is to let them know essentially what it is they're going to hear and then give them a chance to hear it. I also, when I do that, I'll ask them to do me a favor, and I, as Shakespeare, will explain to them that I've had an opportunity during their time to listen to their hip-hop music, and I like it. It has excellent rhythm, wondrous rhyming. It's about fierce passions. It's all stuff Shakespeare wants to put in his own work. But I don't understand a hip-hop song. I don't understand every word of it the first time I hear it. And then I ask them to listen to my work the same way to get a sense of the overall feel and the overall meaning and not to worry about understanding every word. So those two things help a lot, I think, by letting them know what it is going to hear and relieving them of any pressure to try to follow and understand every word of it.
Do you think it's tough for kids today? I mean, there's so much competing for kids' attention. You've got Facebook and YouTube and Snapchat and Vine, that these things that are really fast, and you kind of have to devote a little bit of time to Shakespeare to get to those layers of meaning that you're talking about. Do you think it's a harder sell today than it used to be, or is it the same as it's ever been?
My guess is that it's probably similar to what it's always been, because it, at least since my memory, Shakespeare's language can be challenging, and it requires that you pay attention to it, and it requires that you focus, and in some cases requires some knowledge ahead of time about what certain words mean or what certain word constructions mean. But I don't know that it's any different, and I have ADD. And so I'm really simpatico with kids who have a hard time focusing on something for a long time. And I think that helps me communicate with them in my program, because in my program, I don't really focus on any one particular thing for a considerable amount of time. If I were teaching a college course on it, it would be completely different. But in terms of trying to reach younger people, it moves pretty quickly, and I generally don't have any trouble keeping people's attention. I think that moving quickly and wearing ridiculous pumpkin pants is really all it takes to keep the attention of a younger audience.
And Ron, in that Wisconsin Life piece, you mentioned a suicide as one theme. What other themes or maybe even characters from Shakespeare do kids really seem to relate to or learn from?
They relate to things. One of the things they relate to, it's a scene from Two Gentlemen of Verona where a character named Launce is talking about Crab, his dog. And I'll pull an audience member up and put a hat on them so that they look like a dog and teach them how to bark on cue. And then I'll play this scene with Launce and the audience member playing the dog. And they love that, first of all, because it's ridiculous. But they also love that somebody in the audience gets a chance to go up and completely, totally succeed at being a part of this. And it's the bar is kind, you would think the bar is kind of low, but for some people, it's hard to bark on cue, and we have to spend a little time coaching on it. But that seems to be very, very popular. And I think it's also because it's a place where I have an opportunity to do some fairly broad physical work. And so when I'm doing things physically that reinforce the language, I think that makes it easier to get. And if at any point anybody feels a little bit lost, there's an audience member wearing a ridiculous hat barking like a dog, and that kind of makes up for it.
Why do you think it matters that the next generation gets Shakespeare? That what does Shakespeare give to people that they can't get anywhere else?
I think it's important, and I think it will continue because it's hard. It's a challenge, and everybody understands that it can be hard, and everybody understands that it is a challenge, but it's a challenge you can meet. I've spent time with students who started out being very shy about studying Shakespeare and really intimidated and not liking it because they felt intimidated by it. but they had excellent teachers, and they had a chance to experience it in a way that it made sense. And once that happens, I think it's great for their self-esteem. I think it's great for people's sense of self-esteem. It's almost like conquering something to be able to understand this thing that you thought you weren't going to be able to understand and enjoy this thing that you thought you weren't going to be able to understand. So as counterintuitive as that sounds, I think it has great value because it's difficult, but it's a difficult thing that people can conquer. And when they do conquer it, when they do start to understand it better, there's a huge amount of satisfaction that comes with that.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for joining us and talking Shakespeare today.
I am happy to talk Shakespeare with anybody at any time, especially with you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Ron Scott Fry, the artistic director of Optimist Theater in Milwaukee. We've been talking about introducing the works of Shakespeare to kids. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, Governor Walker wrapped up his campaign kickoff tour this weekend in Iowa. WPR reporter Sean Johnson was there. He'll join us with the details.
First, new data out from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirms something that our parents suspected all along. We're just not eating enough of our fruits and vegetables.
According to the new report, fewer than 15% of adults in America eat enough fruits daily to meet federal recommendations, even fewer when it comes to vegetable consumption. Here in Wisconsin, we follow that national trend. Based on the CDC survey, only 12.5% of Wisconsinites are eating enough fruit. Only 7.5% of us are getting enough veggies. So what are the implications here for public health, and why, despite the health benefits of eating the fresh fruits and vegetables, are we falling down on the job?
Joining us now is Beth Olson. She's an associate professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison and a UW Extension Nutrition Specialist. Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So by and large, this report finds Americans are not eating enough fruits and vegetables. As a nutritionist, what's your take on that?
Well, we've seen this before, and unfortunately, although we've been discussing for years the need for people to eat more fruits and vegetables, we're not having a lot of progress.
And so based on that survey, just to zero in on these results, the CDC found that 12.7% of Wisconsin respondents are eating enough fruit, only 12.7%, and only 7.5% getting enough veggies. And in both cases, Wisconsin is below the national average. Is that surprising to you at all?
Unfortunately, it's not surprising to me. However, I'm a little discouraged that for all the information we've put out, we haven't managed to increase the amount of fruits and vegetables people are eating. And I think one of the things we're realizing is there are many things that are hampering people's ability to do that. And we need to be addressing those other things as well as providing education. So, for instance, we find that there are some people who simply don't have the access to fruits and vegetables that we would like them to have. People living in areas where they're not close to a large supermarket or grocery store that would have the largest amount of fruits and vegetables at the lowest prices, people that don't have good transportation and so can't shop very often. These are groups that we need to work to reach to get them more access, as well as tell them about how important the fruits and vegetables are for their health.
And do you think there's any sort of confusion about what a portion size actually is, how much it is we're supposed to be eating?
There certainly could be. A lot of times people don't realize that if they have a large salad, for instance, that might be two portions, or if they have a large apple, that might be two portions. So it's possible in some cases people are saying that they're only eating one serving when they're really eating two. But given how low the numbers are, I don't think that we have much of the population eating enough.
Well, let's talk about what those recommendations are. What are the federal recommendations for fruit and veggie consumption?
Well, what they tend to do it in is cups. So they move towards saying, and that's because, indeed, people don't know, you know, in an apple versus a banana, how many, you know, how many servings that is. And so for most people, they say about 1.5 to 2 cups of fruit and then 2 to 3 cups of vegetables a day. If you were someone that was a lot more active or a larger person, you would want to, and have more calories in your day, you would want to eat more.
So when you talk about a banana, so let's look at a serving. Is that one serving of fruit or two?
A banana is probably one serving.
Is there a way, a general rule of thumb, that we can think about these things, tips that might make it easier for us to recognize how much it is we're getting or not getting?
Well, I think rather than worrying about the serving size, one of the things we want to do is look at how many occasions could we add in fruits and vegetables that we're not currently doing it. So a typical example might be if you have cereal for breakfast, can you put a portion of fruit on top, sliced bananas or some berries? If you're having lunch, can you add, instead of chips to your sandwich, could you add baby carrots? Things like having two vegetables at dinner with two different colors, which would represent more nutrient groups than just one serving. Or when we're reaching for a snack, could we reach for fruit or vegetables? Since especially vegetables is where we're falling even more short of the recommendations, perhaps cutting up fresh vegetables and having those for a snack as well. And then there might be some other relatively small but important things we could do, like every sandwich you make, can you add on some different kind of lettuce and a slice of tomato or something like that?
And I've read that we're also supposed to be focusing on getting more dark green and more orange, to put it in terms of colors, vegetables and fruits into our diet. How come?
Well, that's because different nutrients actually add different colors to fruits and vegetables. So rather than try to tell people, well, if you want to get this vitamin, here's all the vegetables it has in, or if you want to get this mineral, here's all the fruits it's in. If we tell people eat a wide variety of colors, that will help people increase their different kinds of nutrients. But why we're emphasizing the orange and the green is those are the groups where we're falling rather low. So people are eating more potatoes, for instance, but they aren't eating as many dark green or deep red fruits and vegetables. And those are the ones that are going to have not only the vitamins and minerals that we're kind of more familiar with, like vitamin C or vitamin A, but they have a lot of other things like antioxidants, which also give off color, and a wide variety of antioxidants. So by adding more color to your plate, you can add nutrients without even really thinking about what exactly those nutrients are.
Well, we're talking right now with nutritionist Beth Olson. She's joining us to talk about new CDC numbers showing that Americans, by and large, are not eating enough fruits and vegetables. And, you know, we know that this is something we should be doing. As you said, a lot of educational outreach has been done. But in terms of the consequences, what happens when we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables? What happens to our bodies, or can happen?
Well, we're just generally not as healthy. We're not able to fight off diseases as well. We probably don't have as much energy. We aren't able to perform our tasks as well. Those are kind of the more short-term things. But one important thing fruits and vegetables do is, since they have dietary fiber and in general they have a high water composition, they aren't very high in calories for the amount of bulk that they are. So if we add as many fruits and vegetables as we can to our meals, we may push out some other calories and have a better chance at helping to maintain a healthy body weight. So all those things, both the nutrients and maintaining the good body weight, are really important, not just for how we function and feel right now, but how we, as we age, how our health is. So for kids, that they grow well, but for adults, that we reduce our risk of some types of chronic diseases. And there is pretty good evidence that eating whole food diets, foods that have a lot of whole grains and fruits and vegetables, help reduce our risk of things like certain cancers and heart disease and diabetes, type 2 diabetes.
Now, you mentioned kids, and there was a movement a couple years back, the sort of the sneaky chef thing, maybe it was even further back, about making brownies for the kids, but putting in, you know, a couple cups of pureed spinach that you would never know is there, or black beans in the brownies. What do you think about techniques like that?
I think that's one helpful strategy. I don't think it's the only answer. I don't think, for one thing, we maybe can get as many fruits and vegetables in that way as we would need. And if we don't start exposing our children to actual fruits and vegetables from a young age on, they won't grow up enjoying them and appreciating them and wanting them, and so they won't then add them on their own. So I think that's a great strategy, but I think we also just have to look at how can we introduce them to a really wide variety of fruits and vegetables from very early on. And if they don't like it, that's okay. The next time you try a different one, or perhaps you give them a fruit or a vegetable you know they really like, and then you add another one on the table that they're not so sure about, so that they begin to see it and maybe taste it and be exposed to it. And over time, that seems to help children accept more varieties of fruits and vegetables. They don't have to like everything, but allowing them to try and learn to enjoy a bigger variety, we have a better chance that they'll eat enough as they get older.
Well, I think sometimes, you know, when people are younger and they're healthy, they think, oh, maybe I don't have to eat like that. I can get a lot of exercise. I can ride my bike. I can run and still eat, you know, junk food when I want to, maybe, you know, Oreos, that kind of thing. So is that true? Can you offset it, the Oreos, with the exercise, or does it not work that way?
You can offset a little bit. So maybe you can offset some of the calories. So maybe you're not gaining weight, but you can't offset the nutrients. And so probably if you're an active person, you're not going to perform as well as you could have if you had a healthy diet. And then there is some evidence that some of the damage that happens to our body that results in a chronic disease like heart disease can be happening when we're younger and we're not feeling it. So maybe we're at a healthy body weight, we're not eating that well, but we're beginning to accumulate some plaque in our arteries, which would lead towards heart disease, or we're beginning to gain a little bit of weight and lose a bit of our blood glucose control, and that can contribute to type 2 diabetes. So there's also things that may be happening you're not even seeing. And rather than accumulate that damage as you get older, it would be nicer if we could start out with a better body to begin and not allow that to happen. So then as we got older, we're in a better spot to reduce our risk for those kind of diseases.
Now, you were mentioning barriers to getting fruits and vegetables, things like food deserts or not having reliable transportation to get you to the place where you can get the fruits and vegetables. What needs to change there, do you think, especially here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there are some things available now that people aren't aware of, and so I'd encourage anybody who's concerned to call their county extension office, and they will know where some of the access points are that people may not be aware of. For instance, some local or perhaps a bit small, so they're not as well-known farmer markets. There's also, through extension, they can get hooked up to services through the state that would provide them, if they're low income, with vouchers that let them get fruits and vegetables at their local stores. But I also think we need to work with vendors to increase fruit and vegetable availability in all the places where people show up. So that's where they work, where they play, their corner stores and convenience stores, if those are closer. That needs to go hand in hand in our education. Because if we simply put the fruits and vegetables into the stores, but people don't purchase them, the grocers or other vendors will take them back out again because they don't want to have them rotting on their shelves with no one purchasing them. So we have to really go at it from both ends.
We're talking to nutritionist Beth Olson right now. She's with us to talk about new CDC numbers showing Americans aren't getting enough fruits and vegetables in their diets. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234.
How are you doing when it comes to eating fruits and veggies? If you're getting your recommended amount, how do you do it? If you're not eating enough, why not? Does it boil down to access, cost, taste? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Fruit and vegetable consumption is on our minds this afternoon. A new survey out from the CDC finds that across the board, we as Americans aren't getting the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables that we need. Nutritionist Beth Olson stays with us to talk about the implications of that and why that is. We also want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234.
Do you make it a point to eat the recommended amount of fruits and vegetables each day, and how do you work them into your diet? If you're not eating that good stuff, why not? What could change your behavior? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go first to Paul. Paul joins us in Wausau. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. I have just a couple comments, one on society-wide, and another one would be more of a personal comment and how we've dealt with this. So I been a participant, vendor, farm producer at a number of farm markets around, and I'd say even at the farm markets, the biggest sellers are people selling baked goods and the sweet baked goods, and those people sell an incredible amount, and that's kind of disturbing. And we started another farm market last year, and one of the things I think we're looking at doing is just removing all the baked goods next year. Just out of concern for that, because I think when people are surrounded with, we are as a society, all these, so much junk food is just ubiquitous everywhere you go. I mean, you go to Best Buy, you go to get gas, you go to the grocery store, and the first things you see are just easily consumable, starchy, fatty, sugary foods, and our taste change when we start to eat those, and I think we start to eat less and less vegetables because we get used to eating just sweet food, and then just thought it, blood chemistry changes and whatnot. So, but anyhow, that's one observation I have, that we need to just start removing that stuff from our diet or maybe taxing that stuff. I know that's unpopular, but maybe taxing it in order to encourage people to eat something else. And the second one, on a more personal level, we as a family with our kids, they have to eat their vegetables, including a salad every night, and also some kind of cooked vegetable before they get seconds on the main menu, which may be a favorite food like lasagna or something like that. They have to eat the vegetables first, and then if they want any kind of dessert, which is usually small, the vegetables have to be eaten as well, and regardless whether they like them or not.
All right, Paul, some great talking points there to think about. Really interesting that your little farmer's market thinking of getting rid of the baked goods because they drown out all the veggies. And that has been something we've been hearing a lot of, Beth, of people sounding the battle cry against sugar, saying, you know, sugar is a major culprit in disease and the choices that we make. Do you think that sugar is to blame partly for people not eating enough of the fruits and vegetables?
I think the sugar topic is a tricky one. The science is a bit mixed. I think what we're finding is people consume too many calories. And the extra calories that is contributing to weight is likely coming from sugar. That is, they don't need that extra sugar, for instance, in sugar-sweetened beverages or extra baked goods or extra desserts. And if they remove those, they aren't removing the calories that we would like them to consume of the whole grains and the fruits and vegetables. So I think that's also compounded because we aren't, as a society, quite as active as we used to be, and so we don't have room for a lot of extra treats. On the other hand, we don't want to tell people that, you know, if you have a little bit of sugar, that's going to be awful for you. Many people have, you know, a birthday cake at a celebration, or they do go to the farmer's market and get a sweet roll that they don't normally have, and that's perfectly fine. We just have to learn to balance that with an overall healthy diet so that things that are higher in sugar, higher in some types of fat, are a treat instead of the way that we eat.
And what about parenting techniques? What do you think about how Paul had his kids eat the salad and the cooked vegetable before they could have seconds on anything else?
Well, I think parenting is extremely important, and one of the first things we tell parents in our education is you're a role model. You can't sit and eat, you know, a burger and fries and then tell your child to eat vegetables, you know, their carrots. You need to be the role model for the child and eat the way that you want the child to eat, and you also have to make it available. So if there's lots of fruits and vegetables with the meal and there isn't a meal centered around a very high-calorie other option, then they just won't have it available and it won't be a choice. So the more that you can make things available, be a role model, and also a strategy we often talk to parents about is involving their children. So take your child to the farmer's market and let them pick out one new vegetable each week, or take them to the grocery store. And then when you come home, as their age is appropriate, have them help you wash it or prepare it. And work has shown that our children who are involved in choosing preparing their foods are much more likely to eat them than if they just show up at the dinner table and it's put in front of them and they've never seen it before.
Okay, some great advice there, and thank you for your thoughts, Paul. And we're going to go next to John joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment briefly touched on by the previous caller and by your guests. Availability. With a couple of kids, it's obvious most parents have a hard time getting their kids to eat fruits and vegetables, but a real easy trick, take a cue from grocery stores, the spot in the aisle where manufacturers put the product at eye level in your fridge at home, instead of just putting a bag of carrots or a bunch of grapes. Take the time to clean them and peel it and cut it and just make it easily accessible for your children, so that in addition to making them eat their fruits or vegetables at mealtimes, the snack times, it's super easy, accessible for them to just grab it from the fridge and eat it. And you'd be surprised how fast you have to continue buying fruits and vegetables.
That's another great one. Thank you so much for that, John. Appreciate these ideas. One thing John did spark in my mind there was there is some prep involved with fruits and vegetables. You do have to wash them. You say you've got a bell pepper, you've got to core it and clean it and slice it up. That takes time, whereas a bag of chips you open and you're eating a second later. And Americans now so pressed for time, many family lives so busy. How do we make that time?
That's an excellent point. And I think actually that is perhaps one reason why fruit intake tends to be a little better than vegetable, because you can just grab an apple, a banana, that kind of thing. The vegetables often take a little more preparation, and so they're not as top of mind for a snack. So one of the things is to invest a bit of time, you know, early in the day, in the morning before you go to work, or on the weekend when you come home for the farmer's market. And you can actually take, say, vegetables and blanch them and then cut them up and put them in bags. And then when you come home for dinner, they can be steamed in the microwave very quickly. And then I wanted to add another strategy that we often encourage people to do is really think about canned and frozen fruits and vegetables. We want you to look for ones that don't have added sodium or added fats or sauces or sugars. But then if you do run out of time one night, you can open up the frozen mixed vegetables, pop them in the microwave, and in a minute or two have vegetables. The frozen and canned, as long as they don't have other things added, are still very nutritious. They're generally frozen or canned right out of the field. They're not shipped across the country, even like fresh produce. So, you know, with the nutrients degrading, they're sealed up, if you will, the nutrients in them right away. And so they're very nutritious. And that's another strategy to save time. If one night you just don't have time, or you run out and you don't have any, you can go into the freezer or the pantry and get something that's in a can or frozen in a bag.
And Beth, as we wrap up here, do you think improving cooking literacy would help at all? With some vegetables, you've got the raw option. Otherwise, you might be baffled if you're not used to cooking as much with vegetables, for instance, since that's one of the lowest amounts of consumption here that we're looking at. Do we need to refresh ourselves on how to cook vegetables?
I think we need to refresh ourselves on how to cook vegetables and actually cooking in general. And I encourage people who do have internet access to go to the web and take a look for recipes. And I also think we might think, is there just a little bit different twist on this than I could do? For instance, instead of, if I do have a little more time this evening, could I roast the cauliflower instead of doing it in the microwave to give it a little different flavor? Or could I put it on the grill? Or can I put it into a mixed vegetable and pasta dish versus having my pasta separate from my vegetables? So I think also just making vegetables not the same routine every evening, but mixing it up a little bit might also spark interest in our family and in our kids and consuming more of them.
Well, Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed myself.
That was Beth Olson. She's an associate professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison and a UW Extension nutrition specialist.
So kale chips have been one of my veggies of choice. Kale is in this couple of years, and it's actually, you know, out there being harvested now. Do you have a go-to veggie, Veronica?
Erica Janik from Wisconsin Life introduced me to this delicious kale salad, as long as you're talking kale, with lemon juice, and it sort of macerates and gets soft and easy to eat. It's
macerates.
Delicious.
Plus, you get to say macerates, which I've learned, a word I learned from
yeah,
Central
it's
Time.
Tasty.